So, all, thank you very much for coming to this. My name is Matt Collins. I'm the class of 1994, and I was involved in the programming, better for worse, for this for our class. And I think this is one for the better. I'll just give a very brief preamble and then hand it over to the people you really came to see. So we were thinking up the programs, and Ed Castillo over at the podium here. Shared with us a talk that he had pitched to South by Southwest, which is a big sort of cultural phenomenon, tech show, conference, music festival, all mashed up, that takes place in Texas every year, with a very provocative title about whether reading was a flawed and dying art form. And it was deliberately provocative, I think, as he would say, and we've toned it down or tweaked it a little bit for the purposes of the catalog for the reunion. But it was so good, and it was so, like, meaty, and it screamed interterm 6-week catalog. Or, in our experience, something you might have seen extended for the Introduction to Liberal Studies, or ILS, which was the one mandatory course that we had when we were freshmen back in 1990. And so we urged Ed to come and deliver a flavor of this to this audience and keep it as meaty as he had originally designed it in every respect. But it also elicited some counterpoint, and my guess is we'll get some of that counterpoint, I hope we do, from the audience here today, including from my other classmate, Rob Bernstein, who comes from the publishing industry and for whom reading means an awful lot. And Rob is going to be sharing some empirical evidence that suggests that far from reading being a dying art form, reading is thriving. And so what we have here is a point-counterpoint that we will get into. Ed will go first. Rob will follow. I'll have some questions, but I'm sure your questions will be more interesting, and we'll get to those. So without further ado, Mr. Ed Castillo,
thank you.
You're up first.
Ed Castillo, class of 94, Chief Strategy Officer for TBWA Chiat Day in New York. I've come to offer a point of view about reading, which is a bizarre proposition, as I myself am not a reader. I know how to read. I know that sign says exit. In fact, I find myself reading constantly. I read Twitter posts. I read emails. I read PowerPoint presentations. But I've never been kind of a classic reader. I don't recall having ever read a proper book front to back. Which is an incredible proposition, having come to Amherst and graduated with honors and have a decent job. And that's actually was the genesis of thinking about this, is how on earth have I been able to do that? Now, rest assured, this is not about me. This is just kind of the origin of the idea. I thought to myself, how important is reading if I can actually just listen really closely to my professors and all the really smart people around me and learn the stuff? And often, and particularly in the kind of work I do now, to the extent that I can synthesize ideas to their building blocks and kind of stay away from the weeds, as they say, I'm well suited. So what began is essentially, with kind of a head full of hubris, I started thinking about stuff I had learned in philosophy. I did some graduate work in philosophy. Not easy to do when you're not a reader. And I started thinking about some of the things I had learned in the philosophy of language. And it occurred to me that maybe I can take some of the wind out of reading sails. I've found that in the course of preparing for this, the more interesting idea emerged, which was things learned from reading have this privileged position in our culture. When I talk about having learned something from a video or a conversation, it's sometimes denigrated. So while on one hand I want to make I started with kind of a practical concern: how is it that I've been able to get by without being a reader? But Where it landed was kind of this normative or this moral issue, which is why is it that we privilege information garnered from two-dimensional sets of text? It seems strange to me. Now, as noted, this is to get into South By, you have to be a little provocative. So I gave the title with teeth. Now the title in our manual is closer to the point, which is, will reading go the way of handwriting? I'm not so deranged to believe that reading will disappear. And in a minute, I'll start giving you all the caveats around what I mean by reading, like any good philosopher, and soon this will become more and more narrow, and you'll see the game I'm playing with you. But so this is how I had to allude to the talk to get into South By. Now, as a consequence of doing it this way, there was some hate mail, modern versions of hate mail, and for the because there are children in the room, I'm not going to read these tweets to you. I mean the one at the bottom is just that's pretty good. I mean. So clearly I struck a nerve. I knew I was onto something, right? Maybe not something interesting, but certainly something provocative. So what is the argument itself? It has two components. One is essentially an empirical argument. Are we weeding less and less, or aren't we? And then flawed. And this is where, you know, I start, it becomes a little subjective, and this is where the philosophy of language becomes interesting. If the intention of reading, speaking, and gesturing is to communicate specific meanings, then writing just isn't as good at doing this as sounds, visuals, and gestures are. So that's the big caveat. So you can already kind of see the game I'm playing, right? So for the purposes of this conversation, I want to float the idea that reading and words are a technology that essentially allows someone to take what is in their mind and put it into someone else's mind, right? Now, first to the empirical stuff, and I know Rob's going to talk about this more, so I'm going to breeze through this. And you'll have to forgive me if I run quickly through these slides, because the talk was originally half an hour, and I'm going to try to do this in 12 or 15. So look, the Jenkins Group, I don't know who they are. I didn't do primary quantitative research on the extent to which people are reading. I'm not an expert on it. A quick Google search elicits a lot of information that suggests that people are reading less and less. Right? You can think of your own experience. With this group, it's funny, at South by Southwest, I said you can think of your own experience and make an inference. I think with this group, that's probably a bad strategy. So these are some doomsday numbers. I can't even believe these. Pew gives us some likely more believable stuff. Again, and I imagine Rob's going to be talking more about this. The upshot is, it would seem that long-form reading, that practice is dwindling. People are certainly buying books, right? I'm talking about reading them from front to back. I mean, there's a famous case of all these power brokers in the 80s in D.C. talking about these big tomes that they had read. So one guy went around, he started putting $100 bills past the 250-page mark. None of them were ever discovered. Here's some more data. Again, he's on the empirical side. This is not an empirical argument. I'm not an expert. I suggest to you that people are reading less and less. And I want to get into why. Why do I talk about reading as a technology? I want to resist the intuition that reading is something we do, right? That's a little too simple. I want to suggest to you that reading is something we use, right? We use symbols, and we use the reading of those symbols to transfer information from one mind to another. And we can get into the Wikipedia definition, and if we had more time, I could go into the polemics of this, but I think the idea is clear. Now, I knew people love reading, right? And I walk into a bookstore, and all of my life, I've been overwhelmed by the possibilities of all this great stuff I could learn. And then I buy one, and then I fall asleep, and then I try another one. And whenever I tell people I don't read, it's always the same response, a mixture of disgust and pity, and then a recommendation of some specific book that will get me into reading, which never does. I stopped buying those a long time ago. And then often it's, oh, you must have an attention deficit disorder. And the truth is, I can watch, you know, 3 Star Wars movies back to back very easily, right? I love visuals. To me, the proposition of looking at symbols on the page is ultimately very boring. And I imagine all of you have had the experience of kind of drifting off as you start to read. And where was I? I get that after a sentence or two all the time. So people love reading. And so this was when I proposed the talk, this was the first response, which I thought was great. Reading is over? Absurdity, quoted in the Chicago Business Journal. Visual is important, but language is vital for communication. Now, if I were trying to argue that language is a dying technology, you should certainly take me out back and put me out of my misery. This is a picture by an artist called Everything, and where he went and he wrote every word in the Oxford Dictionary on a canvas. Language is very important. I'm a huge fan of language. I'm talking about the proposition of looking at that language represented in 2 dimensions in symbolic form, and struggling with the problem of reference. How does this thing refer? How do these symbols refer to actual things in the world, right? Sadness and shaking my head. I didn't know what SMH was. I'm glad. Sadness and shaking my head. Reading is a flawed, dying technology. Head shaking is exactly the kind of gesture that the written word describes imperfectly. Now, gestures are very interesting class of phenomena, because on one hand, It's hard to put your hands around them. Yeah, anyone who's traveled in India, for instance, has seen the not the yes, not the no, but the, there's probably a word for it, where they shake their head this way. Very difficult to describe, right? On the other hand, if I say the guy in the room from Tucson, Arizona, who likes to listen to Slayer, I may or may not be alluding to myself. But if I say this guy, it's virtually infallible. Everyone gets that. Gestures are very powerful language phenomena in the world, right? And so that's an important part of the argument. Now, I'm not talking about this kind of reading either. I essentially see this as reading symbols. It's different. And these are all, and as I started telling people about this, I was getting constant counterexamples, which was fantastic. I'm not talking about the kind of reading involved in mathematics or numbers. God forbid we lose kind of numbers and tables, and you know, finance goes out the window, mathematics goes out the window, science goes out the window. And interestingly, and this was the first really interesting counterexample I got, is someone said, what about recipes? And I thought about it. I said, yeah, you know, no matter, despite the rising popularity of the Food Network, no matter how much video you run on someone preparing food, it just can't compete with that. You know, that to me has a real practical, meaningful application in the world. And here's the big caveat, and I understand if you get up and leave after I say this. I'm not talking about this either. Curling up with a book is essentially art, right? Art is not what you see, but what you make others see. I agree with that 100%. The intention with curling up with a good book is that you bring your own imagination to bear on the experience, right? That's a protected class of experiences. I, of course, have no beef with that. I'm talking about situations where the author has a specific meaning or experience in their mind that they want to communicate with someone else, which happens a lot. Journalism, et cetera, right? This is the thing I have a problem only using symbols to kind of represent. And look, I certainly don't have a problem with storytellers and authors. What an amazing thing to have Mark Twain in your ear talking to you. Like that. The whole reason this thing started is I looked at some Salon article once, and I said, oh, this is too long, I can't read it. And then it said, press the button to hear the author give his argument. And I said, this is fantastic, because the inflection and his voice. Within 30 seconds, I said, oh, now I'm actually learning something. If I'm staring at these symbols on a page, it's kind of boring. I may take something out of it, I'll probably fall asleep. So let's get into the meat of it. And again, keep in your mind throughout this that all of this kind of hubris is really intended to kind of support the moral argument. Why is reading so privileged, right? I'm certainly not trying to discourage anyone from actually reading, but let's give it a shot anyway. The experience on the right, I think we'll all agree, has more information than the experience on the left in a really important way, right? This is breaking it down as simply as possible. You take it up the chain a little higher, and you start to think of something like this. Unless you are familiar with that image on the right, no amount of information like the information presented on the left can do it justice, I would argue. Now, for those who think it's only about the words, it's about the language, well, I propose this.
I could have been a contender.
Right? Does not live up to it, right? Not as good. You start to have things like this also, too, which is a very easy problem in the philosophy of language, right? You have what a philosopher would call, so looking at that red box, a philosopher would call that experience having a quale, the phenomenal property of the experience associated with having an experience, or qualia, right? This is the plural, right? That quale is associated with all different kinds of ways of reference in the world. So again, little by little, I want to kind of decouple the experience from the symbolic representation, because that sits at the center of my intuition. Now, I'm going to go to extreme examples, but I think it's a lovely way to demonstrate where language falls, and this is one of my favorite. Does anyone know this sentence? I learned this sentence from Professor Alexander George here on campus in 1992. This sentence is a grammatically sound, logically clear sentence in English that everyone in this room should be able to read and clearly understand. Buffalo is a city, buffalo is an animal, and buffalo is also a little-known verb to coerce someone to do something, right? So I'll read this with the proper inflection. Buffalo, 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 buffalo. So it's as though I'm saying, New York rats smell New York rats. Okay. The truth is, that sentence actually, you can do it to eight places. I still can't put my head around this. I've met people who can. They try to explain it to me. And so not only reading, but sometimes people, smart people explain, that even has limits. Someday I hope I understand that. I'll come back and explain it to you. So anyone in the room who knows who this guy is probably seeing the game I'm playing, right? Wittgenstein, it's precisely because words lack a specific meaning, because they're kind of fuzzy, that's why language works. you might be squirming in your chair thinking, well, this guy's crazy. You know, he's doing exactly the wrong thing. He's misinterpreting the way language works. And so that leads us into this whole notion, and this is where I'll probably jump. How long have I been talking?
Maybe three, Keith, through three more minutes.
Oh, okay, cool. Well, this is an awesome thing about how the word no is a problematic word in English. Anyone who speaks a Romance language, for instance, if you speak Spanish, you understand that the difference between saber and conocer, both ways of saying no, one is knowledge by description and one is knowledge by acquaintance. They're very different things. For some reason, we use the word no in English and think we can get away with it. And why that's interesting is, I want to reinforce, this is Mary, the neuroscience educator in the Black-White Room, which we don't have time to go into, unfortunately, but I want to kind of reinforce this idea that you have experiences in the world. You sit in a certain state of affairs with objects in the world, and you can have a record of that experience, an approximation of that experience, and then down at the bottom you have this kind of lame thing that writing is, which is a description of that experience. This was a response to my talk from someone in the South by Southwest community, which it wasn't until he wrote this that I started to think, well, maybe I actually do have a decent argument, because he said, love it and hate it, as I like to read, but I think you may be right that I'm antiquated. See all, and then of course, like everyone else, he gives me all these books that I can't read. It was really interesting that he said antiquated, because that's when it hit me. Just the opposite. The reason I think this happens is because reading is too new. We are visual creatures. Our brains have developed in such a way to suck information from the world in a way visual that I just don't think symbols on a page can hang with. And once you start adding sound, gestures, texture, the whole, like, it's just obvious. I mean, in fact, when I started thinking about this more, I said, I'm going to walk into a room and this is just going to seem trivial. Of course reading is flawed compared to all these things, right? My classmates started responding, and this got interesting. I won't read it all to you because I'm running out of time, but this idea, people started twisting themselves in these rhetorical knots to respond to me, and I thought it was really interesting. So this guy says, I find video to be coercive and almost inherently irritating as a mode of persuasion. So people thought I was talking about things like movies. No, I'm talking about the thing you're doing right now. You are looking at me, right? So that mode of experiencing the world is irritating. You'd rather experience the world through symbols on a page and not the way you actually do, which is, for those of us lucky enough to have sight, seeing the world and hearing the world. It's just kind of interesting that the assumptions people make when I say that there are flaws in reading. All right, so rounding the corner, I'm gonna skip through all this kind of stuff. There are all these new ways of emerging, of thinking about reading, which to me suggests that I may have some leverage, some purchase in the argument, because people are saying, yeah, you're right, you know, there are ways to improve reading. And this is actually kind of cool. I've started trying to do this, and I may become a reader yet. This is kind of an interesting technology. If you're not yet familiar with it, very interesting. But here's where it starts. If I haven't said anything interesting yet, I hope you'll find this interesting. This is my last slide. This is recent experiments in neuroscience at UC Berkeley, where they've essentially taken supercomputers and they do fMRI studies, functional magnetic resonance. You know, they look at the way blood flows in the brain when people are reading things and watching things, right? And after, what they do is they send people through these machines for hundreds and hundreds of hours, and the computers start noticing these patterns. Oh, when you see red, this happens in your brain, and when you see black, this happens in your brain. The voice you're going to be hearing is Google's head of display technology, and she's talking about the experiment. But just to clarify ahead of time, what's happening here is the computer learns so much that it gets to the point now where you can show someone something, and the computer is only seeing the person's brain. What's happening in their brain? And the computer says, "Here's what I think they're seeing in their consciousness," and it's remarkable how close it gets.
On the right-hand side, you see the computer's guess, and on the left-hand side, the presented clip. This is the jaw dropper. We are so close to being able to do this, we just need to up the resolution. And now remember that when you see an image versus when you imagine that same image, it creates the same brain scan.
So if you think it's strange that someone is standing up here arguing that representing meaning in symbols is kind of falling out of fashion, I submit to you that in not long in the future, there may be far more direct ways of sending quale to quale. When computers can start making inferences about what's happening in my consciousness as a consequence of the blood moving through my brain, and we're in such an infancy with neuroscience, I have a feeling that in the future, meanings are gonna move in ways that are gonna make reading seem really, really quaint.
Very good. Thank you, Ed. So we'll get to, I promise we'll get to questions, and my guess is that you have several things you'd like to throw at Ed. And,
throw it like
literally. And you may have some things for Rob here, too. But now for a counterpoint, I'd like to hand it over to Rob Bernstein.
Well, I have to say, you may only use 20% of your brain when you're reading, but I have to say, when I watched the recent Godzilla film, I think maybe 5%. So, just saying. So, listen, the South by Southwest presentation, really provocative, very interesting. Some really compelling points there. They're definitely making me think twice. But I think, you know, looking through the data to see, are people really, really reading less? Are they consuming less long-form reading content? I think that what you're going to find, and what I found, was that honestly, it's not that it's in decline; it's actually flourishing. So, let me just give you kind of a quick state of the publishing industry today. So, book publishing vacillates wildly from year to year, like the film industry. It has its hits and it has its misses. You have your years of your Harry Potters. You have your years where you have your 50 Shades of Grey, and then you have your years where you don't have your hits. So it vacillates, but you know, while they may be biased, I really believe what Publisher Weeklies is saying is that the publishing industry, for the most part, has stabilized. It definitely saw some declines, but at this point, it has stabilized. And in fact, in 2013, they saw a modicum of growth, very modest growth of 1%. E-books have been flourishing. In the last few years, have seen triple-digit growth. Last year saw double-digit growth. It's really maturing as a business for the book industry. So long-form reading, it seems, at least from the consumer perspective, stabilized. The magazine industry, very different. Newsstand is in a death spiral. And it's a real challenge for magazine publishers. In the last year, I think, year over year, newsstand sales were down double digits. And this year alone, in the first quarter, down 11%. But I don't think this is reading that is dying. What you're seeing here is a distribution channel that is definitely dying. People simply aren't going to the newsstand anymore. There's no reason to go to the newsstand anymore. Paid subscriptions, on the other hand, are flat year over year, and digital editions of magazines are up 100% year over year. Now, the delta between digital editions of magazines and the loss of newsstand is still pretty wide, but that business is relatively healthy. But some serious challenges for magazine publishers. Ed pointed out the Pew study, and I think the real key takeaway from the Pew study wasn't so much that people aren't reading as much anymore. What they found was that from 2012 to 2014, if you believe people who answered the question in the study, if they read, that the numbers actually increased 2% over there. And so a very modest increase, but not that massive decline that you might have expected when you saw the Gallup poll data from years before. So what is that attributed to? Well, the Pew study really found that it was technology, right? It was access to all this content. If you go into the iBook store, you have access to 30,000 free eBooks. It's amazing, amazing unfettered access. And if you look at the chart at the right, you'll see that the platforms for consuming readable material are rising. So if people don't want to read and it's a dying art form, why are people purchasing e-readers still? Why are they purchasing tablets, which granted are multifunctional? But you see that these platforms are very healthy for reading, are definitely on the rise. So let's take a look at the film industry. Let's look at long-form video. And I thought this was pretty interesting. Is long-form video dying? Well, look at studio films of late. Disney released 22 movies in 2002. Last year they released 12 years. I'm sorry for the children here that see that sad Mickey. I apologize. and this year, Disney is only releasing 11 films. Sony saw 31 movies in 2002, and you can see the decline down to 18 this year. And so almost universally, except for, oddly enough, Universal, film studios are releasing fewer and fewer films. If you look at movie tickets sold, you'll see, you know, the trending line there. People are just aren't going to the theaters anymore. And I think you're kind of seeing it's the same thing as you see with newsstands. Fewer and fewer people are consuming long-form video content at the movie theater. And what about TV viewing? Across all demos, but particularly interesting, so the millennial demo and the key 18 to 24 advertising demo, you're seeing that they are spending less and less time watching traditional TV for the last 8 consecutive quarters. They're spending their time elsewhere. So TV as a different kind of long-form content, also in decline. So what does this mean? Is long-form video dying? No, it's not dying. You're seeing output from studios definitely slowing. Traditional TV viewing time definitely in decline. What I thought was really interesting, though, is with Sundance, you saw this year more than 4,000 films were submitted, up from 3,200 in 2007. Technology is allowing these sort of smaller content creators to be more prolific and get in the game. So the conclusions that I saw, one, business model changing dramatically for studios, access to inexpensive technology, a real boon to the independent producer, and technology obviously transformative for these guys, and then long-form video content moving out of these sort of tentpole films that the studios have been producing and now producing these more tadpole films. You don't really see too many $30 to $50 million films anymore. So what does this have to do with reading? Well, the business model is also changing for publishers, right? So they have to also deal with the high cost of creating blockbuster titles. Access to ubiquitous digital platforms is allowing independent authors to really be more prolific and put more content out there. Now, that's not suggesting that people are reading more. They're definitely outputting more content. And down here, it's funny that you mentioned Salon earlier, and I thought this was really interesting. If you look at the ComScore data, the data that measures the success and audience of key websites, you'll look at some of these websites, and if you viewed any of them, Grantland, which is a great ESPN site, Salon, Slate, Atlantic, New Republic, all year over year showing double-digit monthly unique growth. Those sites really only focus on long-form readable content. Some photo galleries and video content, but for the most part, that's just readable content. So you're seeing great growth. People are going to these platforms, and that's to say nothing of the short-form content, tweets, emails, those ridiculous caption BuzzFeed articles. So I would argue that you're probably reading more than ever. And I thought this slide was really interesting. This is just media consumption as a whole. And the eMarketer released a study that just basically said we as people are just consuming more media than ever before. If you look at that top line that's trending up, that's the number of hours that eMarketer discovered people are consuming, the amount of media they're consuming per day, nearly 12 hours. And you may wonder, there's no way people are spending half their day consuming media. But this number was crunched looking at the idea that people are actually consuming media on multiple platforms now, second screens, third screens, and it's just going up. I think the plotting for 2015, the suggestion is people are going to be spending 15 hours, and there's a possible trajectory that you'd be spending more time than there are hours in the day consuming media because of all these different platforms that you have available to you. But look at all the other platforms, all flatlined, right? They're, radio, print, film, TV. It's the consumption of that content on the digital platform that's causing this rise. I just thought this was funny. I just did an exercise with my staff. You can maybe get through 3 Star Wars back to back, but I challenge anyone here to watch both versions of Dune back to back. We talk a little bit about just the ability to for video to kind of provide you with that image that's more powerful than the words and text itself. I would say all of these films, and I apologize to anyone here who likes any of these films. I find it hard to believe that that anyone's a fan of Captain Corelli's Mandolin. But just some good reads and colossal failures in the film medium. Just don't translate. And lastly, I just would leave this sort of final thought I thought was really interesting. If reading really were dying, why are world illiteracy rates dropping so dramatically? Right? More people than ever are reading, and this is going to continue. This is a UN study. You're going to get a larger base of readers. You're really going to see more reading than ever before. It's becoming more and more available to the world. So that's it, Matt. Send it back to you.
Great. Thank you, Rob. That's great.
Thank you.
So we have about 15 minutes before we've got to clear out. I've prepared some questions, but my guess is you've got better ones. So I'm going to hand it right over to the audience. Who would like to go first? Go ahead.
They've done studies of people who do not know how to read, and they perceive the world differently, psychologically.
Sure.
In terms of neural activity. And so I was curious if any of you could comment on that.
Yeah.
Before you begin, because we're recording this, actually, I'm going to repeat the questions as they come out because we don't have mics for the audience. So the question was about the
extent... People who do not know how to read, see the world differently, and that's been researched in terms of neural activity as to how this difference occurs in the brain.
Mm-hmm. Right. So the point is, people who don't know how to read do visualize the world differently.
Sure. As I was preparing my stuff, I stumbled onto an Economist article, which fortunately was also a video, and I watched the video, and it made a striking claim, which was that the extent to which children before the age 3 hear words, it's a predictor of their IQ. So the more variation in language they hear as young children, this has an effect. So I think that's it's a related issue, and it's an issue long studied in the philosophy of language. This idea that to see certain things, you have to have the concept. How can you see? How do you know what you're looking at? Right. And so when I spoke at South By, one of the first questions someone asked me afterwards was interviewing me. He said, "Do you have children?" And I said, "Yes, I have 2 children." He said, "Are you teaching them to read?" And I said, "Yes." And he said, "Why?" and I think precisely because of what you say and what you point out, which is true, it makes perfect sense that understanding concepts. So having language is critical.
We define concepts with language now.
Correct. Right. Totally, but I don't think reading, the reading point is purposefully bombastic, but if I want to lean into it, the use of language does not require reading. I can know words and I can be familiar with the definition of a word without having read it. I've probably never read the word pusillanimous, I don't even know it, I'll think of a better example. But you know, there are a number of words that I've heard and haven't yet read, but I know their meaning.
Pick one from the spelling bee last night, for example. Yeah.
But your point's interesting. I mean, what you're saying is that, you know, the thought process, the creative process, something sometimes happens through the writing and the reading. You know, I don't think any good storytelling happens without any writing or reading. Any long-form story exists first as readable text. Actors in a play or in a film have to have readable material in order to, you know, execute that film and that storytelling vision. So
5,000 years ago, everything was verbal tradition, memorization.
Mm-hmm.
No reading.
Right.
So I guess the question is the difference between us then and us now. Mm.
It's a great point.
As I was trying to study neuroscience when I was an undergraduate here, I had some of my most spectacular academic failures in this room, in this very room, in chemistry. So unfortunately, I'm not in the position to answer your question. I wish I could.
Why don't we move on to another one? Ben, go ahead. So the question is, if there is an erosion, the ability of young people today to be able to process and read and comprehend and analyze longer form reading, is that a symptom of a long-term problem? Rob, what do you think?
I think it's a problem. I mean, I don't know if this is sort of apropos, but I just look at, like, there's certain things that don't require reading. But I look at, you know, ironically enough, you know, some of the tech guys, you know, on our team, and they cannot learn how to code by watching video. They simply can't.
They must write code and read code. Any coder would tell you that's how you learn and that's how you create in that process. So I think there are things that just require reading and writing in order to accomplish.
Yeah. No, I mean, obviously the ability to project and have imagination is critical. I mean, for the purposes of my argument, that's mainly why the caveat around communicating a specific meaning. Again, creating a world in your mind, an important and powerful thing, I have no beef with that. My beef is if in the instances where I have something very specific in my mind and I want you to have that specific thing in your mind, I would prefer using video. My experience suggests that using video, sound, and gestures will make that happen better than reading alone.
Great.
One thing that struck me in this conversation is perhaps the difference is more between the focus, the density, and the length of the information. Mm. I work in IT for a school district, and one thing I noticed when I came in, before the internet was quite as ubiquitous as it is now in schools, is that we had a problem with kids who wouldn't go home to read because they had DVDs, they had cable, they had all the rest of it. But then the internet exploded in a way that kids were much more focused on, and a lot of them picked up reading more because we had the social networks that required a lot of reading.
Yes.
But now we're seeing another generation of that, where with Instagram, YouTube, and the rest of it, short video clips are becoming the thing again.
Yes.
And so it seems to be the cycle of video reading, video, visual reading, depending on where the technology is. However, one thing that, as you just pointed out, visual is not good at sometimes is density of abstract thought.
Yes.
And as we talked about math or the rest of it.
Sure.
As a whole, we would like to think that everybody in the past sat down and read, defined and called the Roman Empire. But the fact of the matter is that that was generally for a very rare Roman set.
Yes.
And when I think of something like the Robert Taylor's books on Robert Moses, Power Brothers, the Lyndon Johnson biographies and those kinds of things, those are things that take an enormous amount of effort to create, an enormous amount of effort to consume, and they're still going to happen. They're still going to require reading, but I think we're trying to spotlight a little bit on the fact that they are not the norm, they right. are the exception.
Yeah, so the point, and I'm not going to do it justice, but it speaks to the notion that I think both of you recognized in your talks, that the form or the medium in some ways is dependent on the density of the information contained in the medium. And that for some things, and even Ed acknowledged in his talk, that mathematics or recipes may be a form of communication that requires a written form in order to accommodate that kind of information density.
Yeah. If I may, I'd love to reply specifically on the Robert Caro point because it reminds me of something at the heart of my intuition, which is I of course have never read any Robert Caro. I have heard him talk though, and I got a ton out of it. And so my intuition is. I would much rather have him talk to me about these stories. We have technology that very easily allows us to capture him talking about this stuff and for me to press a button and see it for free.
The power broker is about
70 hours. Sure, absolutely, absolutely. I mean, but the intuition is, it's in the past, made perfect sense that to take information and make it portable. We didn't have video. It wasn't easy to move sound around. Of course, reading's a fantastic technology. We have other means of delivering information now, which, in my experience, focus group of one, is a richer, more lasting, more meaningful experience than staring at symbols on a page. Again, this may just be a limitation of my own neuroscience. You know, so.
Yeah. Yes, ma'am. Go ahead.
I'm wondering what you think of photographs versus reading, because I'm thinking of how many people would look at a video of a special event versus a photo album.
Mm.
And by photo album, I don't necessarily mean the old-fashioned kind. I mean uploading pictures to CVS and
sure.
go 2 hours later and pick up a book.
Right.
Yeah, so...
I go through the photo album much or photo book much more readily than I do looking through a video.
Yeah.
So the question here is really about the introduction, perhaps a third concept that we didn't touch on.
Varieties of visual.
Yeah, variety of visual presentation. Yeah. So we've talked about video, we've talked about word, but what about photography?
Yeah. Well, I just think, you know, with a photo, you have that wonderful memory of that moment. You know, when you see it, it conjures up all those memories, which is very powerful. You know, I go through, you look at the sort of wedding tapes that we have. I much prefer looking through the wedding photos. We look a lot happier, by the way. and the video just goes on and on and on. I kind of get what I need out of a photo, and I can move on, and it tells a story that's a lot more lasting and happy.
I'm glad you bring that up, because I'm going to say something that may seem counter to my intuition about reading, which is, and maybe this is probably conditioned by having worked in advertising for 20 years, but the still photo reveals so much of the intent of the photographer, right? Versus kind of the dopey camera just kind of sitting there. Obviously, cinematography in movies is a protected class, but so I quite prefer the still visual image and the drama associated with kind of what I intuit to be the intention of the artist, right? Which is probably what everyone is saying. Well, that's what reading is. That's what's happening when you're reading. Why don't you just kind of appreciate reading in the same way? And for some reason, I don't. They feel very different to me. So it's an interesting point of view.
We had some questions over here. Rita, go ahead.
Okay. So if I'm understanding it correctly, there seems to be sort of three languages happening simultaneously in this discussion of reading. The first one for me was sort of visual cinematic language, which you talked about. Then the secondary was literary text, which I'm obviously Jane Austen. And then the third would be verbal communication. And what I'm also hearing is kind of two domains, information versus imagination.
Yes.
So to ask a sort of leading question,
sure.
What do you think the value and future of an Amherst education is? Because as a graduating senior, I remember many, many nights spent holed up over massive textbooks.
I mean, let me just
capture it. So what's the value in an Amherst education dominated by having to put your nose in some fat books? Although, Ed, you managed to escape that.
Yeah, so
maybe the question is, what's your secret, man?
This is being recorded.
I mean, hey, you got your diploma.
I don't want you guys to strip the degree or the honors or anything, but yeah, it's not a necessary part of the experience of being at Amherst to have your nose in books. In fact, we have a class... a survey, and they said, this is so smart-ass, I should have done it, but one of the questions was, what are you most curious about your classmates? What do you want to ask them? And my response was all that reading worth it? Because, look, I sat around and had conversations with John Haskell, and he had read the stuff, and he synthesized it, and I walked away with the knowledge. I walked away with the knowledge. And we both paid for the knowledge, and he had to slave.
John, it's time to collect. Rob, do you have anything?
No, listen, I mean, what's the value of it? I mean, I just think people learn differently, and it depends on what you're learning, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, different mediums work better for certain things. You know, you point out the recipe thing. I mean, I certainly couldn't watch someone cook a meal and learn how to do it. You're sitting there pausing it, you know, rewinding it, trying to keep up. I'd rather just have the instructions, right? But then there are things I see, you know, coworkers who use lynda.com, which is this great site that gives you all sorts of wonderful video tutorials that teach you things. There's certain things that it just can't teach you. So, I mean, however you learn, as long as you come away with the knowledge, I think that's right, the value of the education.
Well, and the value of the education is that you ask that question, in my mind, ultimately.
Very Amherst-y. Yeah, go ahead, over here.
It's a great adjective.
Yeah, there's a body of knowledge which relates to, you gave that to the media choice, or media richness theory, and it says that at one end of the spectrum, the most rich interactions we can have are face-to-face, because you can smell the person, you can feel the person, you can look at the person, you get a sense of their emotional, on their face, and so on. So at the far end, so there was a, and you bring that with technology. Technology then tried to recreate that experience back in the 60s, 70s with picture phones, and it failed miserably because people didn't really want to see each other that closely.
Right. From
distance, you want to come out of your bathrobe or something and not really let people know that. But at the other end of the spectrum, you know, which was these impoverished kind of, you know, tall type messages that we would send at one end. And so the goal was like, can we create media that transmits much greater experience? And consequently, you know, we put a lot of money into doing that. And of course, we have, you know, we have face phones on iPhones, and we can
Yep.
We can do whatever we want. But then look at it now. I'm wondering if we're kind of in this evolutionary period where it's kind of bifurcating in interesting ways. Because then you see, right, Twitter. Like Twitter, when it came out, it's the dumbest idea from media richness theory.
Right.
It's like 140 characters. That's so stupid. And media richness theory predicts that we would put all our money into media-rich activities and technologies. That's just dumb. Okay, well, it's not dumb.
It's totally
powerful. And now, you know, and so, but on the other hand, then you see the rise of reading through the Kindle and through e-books and so
yes.
on. So it seems that people are kind of selecting into camps. They're saying, you know, I would rather communicate with pictures, Instagram, right? So, and so there's a whole population that's becoming the Instagram group, you know, that says, I would rather converse with my friends. I really care about this. You know, words aren't that important.
Right, right.
And think about, you know, how do we communicate formally? We put your pictures on the wall. You know, say, hey, here's my picture, here's your picture. So now there's a whole group that does that, but there are people who tweet, and they prefer to tweet, but tweeting almost seems passe next to the pictures,
right?
Because you can send the pictures that much faster, and you're like, oh, I got a picture, that's great. But on the other hand, reading requires much, much more work. It takes more work to create. It takes much more work to assemble and to assimilate and so on. And we have to ask ourselves, you know, the people who are willing to put the time in to master that skill, either writing or reading, are getting some sort of additional benefit out of it. And so, you know, when you look at the progression of humanity, I mean, we went through the Enlightenment period, and, you know, we tried to make available reading as widely as possible. So we kind of run the risk of kind of, I think at this point, we're moving into different, you know, subpopulations.
Yes.
This will be the picture group, this will be the short sentence tweeting group, and this will be the more, the rich, so I think we're in danger of almost like the Hunger Games, you know, the group and the more specialties, you know, these people, they don't really need to read, they just go beat people up when they get out. So I'm kind of wondering what's going on because, you know, I teach, I'm a faculty member in the business school at Penn State, and I used to teach media richness theater theory, and I'd say, okay, well, this is where the media's going, this is where the technology's going. And then, you know, it's all those girls are kind of in the last 10 years completely out the window.
Yeah.
So to summarize, the media richness theory would suggest that we've been moving to richer, richer forms, but maybe we're jumping off of the evolutionary path and going into uncharted waters of shorter form, longer form, richer form, and who's going to be right in the end?
Yeah, you know, I'm not sure I totally agree in that sort of Hunger Games analogy. You know, when I read a story online on a website, those stories now, when we craft them on our own site, they're text with embedded videos, embedded galleries, hyperlinks. You're consuming content now that has all of that kind of melded together. That's the kind of interesting evolution to me, is that it's not just one piece of content. It's all of this content's kind of getting squished together. And if you look at the data, people consume it all. They go through, you see a very interesting news story, you'll read through the story, you'll click through the photo gallery, and you may actually consume the video as well. I know with Facebook, you know, or with Twitter, there are times I just want to say, hey, I'm eating a ham sandwich. You know, if I'm at a beautiful sunset, well, a tweet doesn't quite do it, right? So, I mean, it's what are you trying to communicate at a given moment? And certain platforms are just better at it.
There's something I've noticed both kind of professionally at work and in studying groups of people and trying to understand why they do what they do, I think is a nice illustration of what you're saying. And that's, so it's, I'll introduce a kind of, on the continuum you suggested between photo images and tweets. So one has this narrative direction and one is open interpretation. There's this great confluence in the middle with GIFs. And some
you pronounced
GIFs.
It correctly.
Thank
no,
you.
Apparently
okay, good. GIFs. Choosy marketers really choose GIF. That's how I keep that clear in my mind. And that is, for those who don't know, a series of images that essentially millennials, when they send each other emails now, more often than not, they send each other GIFs, which are kind of quick. They have some narrative structure because you see something happening, but they're ultimately visual, right? So it's kind of the intersection of those two worlds. So in my experience, I do think there's a tribalism related to age around how people use information and communicate.
So we are going to be, I'm sure all of us, sort of wanting to go and back to our home bases here in about 5 minutes. So I'm going to take one more question, and I think I want to get this one over here, and then we'll wrap it up. So go ahead. You've got the last one.
I would like to have a comment on the way that the words are structured
So the observation was that maybe the structure, the way we architect words on the page, the form of going left to right and up to down, is an impediment.
Absolutely. I mean, that's certainly. And I showed the spritz example. I think the scientists who developed that, I think, were very much motivated by the intuition you have, which is, you know, half of the effort is your eyes focusing on the word, you know, getting it. So I absolutely. I mean, again, in my mind, that only helps my argument. You know, ultimately, I want to see the delivery of meaning that does away with the need for these kind of these artifacts. Where again, I want to suggest the hyperbolic claim that at some point in the future we'll be able to deliver meaning to meaning. It'll be mediated by nothing at all but the meaning itself. But that's a little scientific. That's a little
sci-fi.
I recognize.
So I will volunteer these guys to you if you'd like to ask them questions or seek them out through the alumni database. I know we all love to hear from fellow Jeffs and would be happy to continue. But this brings us to an end. I just want to thank Ed and Rob for a great presentation.
Thank you.